What's up, y'all? It's the fourth quarter. It's a new month. And what better way to start it than to come and to join us at EYL University?
Yes, the fourth quarter is where star players make a name for themselves. So come and join the number one roster. EYL University is the biggest platform for business in the universe. We have over 70 past classes, weekly classes. We have a private investment group on Facebook, which gives you access to our movie club, our book club. We also have bi-weekly real estate calls with MG, the mortgage guy, and monthly financial advising calls with none other than yours truly. So head over to EYLUniversity.com right now and enter promo code EYL for 40% off of our annual membership.
That's right. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over. We'll see you on the other side.
Earners, what's up? Look, in the world of personal finance management, finding the right tool is crucial. If you've been relying on Mint to keep your personal finances in check, I got a mix of news for you. Mint is closing down. But here's a silver lining. Monarch Money is stepping up as the go-to financial app, and users, including myself, are making the switch with a smile. Before Monarch, juggling my finances felt like navigating a stormy sea. Other apps either lacked features or were too cumbersome. Then came Monarch Money. Its ease of use, powerful features, and sleek design turned financial management from a chore into a breeze. The constant updates, well, that's the cherry on top. But what truly set it apart for me was its collaboration feature. Money matters can strain relationships, but Monarch brings peace to the table. The app's collaboration tools allow my partner and I to seamlessly manage our finances together. We aligned on our budgets, tracked our cash flow, and even planned our future goals all in one place. Speaking of goals, be it saving for a down payment, your dream vacation, or your children's education, Monarch simplifies it all. It's no wonder the Wall Street Journal hailed it as the best budgeting app. This isn't just an app. It's the next generation of personal finance management, ad-free, intuitive, and always evolving with you in mind. Now look, Monarch isn't just another app. It's the all-in-one solution, from effortlessly importing your data from Mint to customizing your dashboard to your heart's content. Monarch respects your privacy with a strict no ads, no data selling policy. This is financial management as it should be, focused on you. Look, after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Mondays. That's monarchmoney.com/Mondays for your extended 30-day free trial.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, I appreciate you being here. Let's see how much of a delay we have, and then we'll go until they come back in.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll make it happen, you know? Maybe we have to get a court reporter to get in here and type up a transcript or something.
Man, we may need it tonight, but I appreciate you. You want to dive right in?
Yeah, unless you want to wait for the guys, but yeah, man, like no need to thank me. Like I said, I'm here to be of service. Love what you guys are doing. And if I can be a resource, I think it's important that people have this information and get it from an unbiased source with no agenda. I heard the disclaimer. I'm just going to throw out my own. So I'm definitely not serving in an advisory capacity. These views are my own, not of CNBC, not of XP Investments, my company, or any other affiliate. I'm just here to give you guys the real, the way I see it. But I would always encourage everybody to do their own research. And I'm going to try to, you know, I'm here a little bit earlier today. Hopefully I can get into the weeds a little bit and give you guys some more in-depth type of analysis on maybe what you should be looking at, how to look at it, and really, you know, try to equip you with the tools needed to kind of make your own decisions, which is really what this is about, right? I'll let you kind of lead this, Ian, but I did want to kind of kick off by saying, like, there's no cookie cutter way to do this. I mean, I know for you personally, and I know myself, like, a lot of this stuff, you know, is trial and error. You know, you learn from your victories and your defeats. And so I would caution anyone from just following anything that you read or consume via digital media or whatever else blindly, right? From anyone, myself included. I don't care if it comes from Ray Dalio. You should pick up the book or the article or kind of tear through the company's balance sheet yourself, because, and Ian, hats off to you. Listen, when you have mentors that can lead you in the right direction, the information that they're giving you is technical. It's a how to do this. There is no replication for how to think about doing this. So hopefully I can come here and give you not only the technical know-how in terms of how to execute X, Y, and Z, but the critical thinking that goes behind being able to execute X, Y, and Z. So just wanted to say that, really looking forward to it. You know, we can kick it off.
Can y'all, are we back?
Yes, you're back.
Yep.
All right.
We're back.
It's one of, we got to breathe in, brother. Okay. It's going to be okay. Man.
They know I have high levels of anxiety.
he got the Arthur hand balled up right now.
Absolutely. Zoom, today's going to be the last day. Arrivederci. But if I can dive in, so
it's been fine.
Absolutely. Bottom line, I'm seeing a lot of misinformation on social. Can you walk us through the proper way that a professional would structure a portfolio so people aren't getting caught up in the hype of what is being posted online and on social media today?
Absolutely, man. That's a great question. And kind of ties into what I was saying earlier. I thought about coming on here, and I know some people have seen some of the questions like, yo, so what stock is this X, Y, and Z? And I'm like, I really want to, listen, I'm here to serve. This won't be my first time. Won't be my last time. I'll get to all the questions. But in terms of how to structure a portfolio, or in terms of how I would structure a portfolio, you have to have like a core holding. Right. And I think that depending on whether or not, the first question is, you need to ask yourself, what's your risk tolerance? And I know that sounds kind of cliche, but it's super important, right? Like, are you trying to maintain wealth, or are you trying to create wealth? So maintenance is really about just making sure, is really about protecting your downside. So your volatility of returns, the amount of risk that you're willing to take, should be significantly lower than if you're actually trying to generate and create wealth. So a lot of the stuff that I see is like, okay, let's have this all option portfolio, or what stock should I buy? Excuse me, or how long should I hold X, Y, and Z? For me, it's always easier for me to make small alterations when I have a core position that I like. So to give you an example, 70% stocks, 30% bonds, right? That's something super vanilla. Or 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or an index fund that does that. Because now when you're, I'm not suggesting that you actually trade different bonds, because that becomes much more complicated. If you have an institutional backer or institutional firm that will deploy this capital for you, sure. Stocks and bonds and any kind of balance that works for you. For someone who's like kind of just getting started, I would look at either like a Vanguard index fund or an SPY ETF, and that will give you general exposure, and we'll get more into ETFs later. But personally, in some of my investments, I'm like 80-20. I'm relatively young. I'm 37 years old, and I'm not risk averse. And I've had to kind of like get this out of the mud, right? So I'm fine with the risk. But yeah, if you're asking me like kind of what I have for some of like my 401k allocations or different tranches of investing, and we can get into that later, but just a core position, I think if you have 60 to 70%, anywhere between 60 and 80% stock, anywhere between 20 to 40% bonds. And if you want to sprinkle in or like a bond index, like AGG will give you that. Yeah. You want to sprinkle in commodities or something like that, that's fine too. But I think the basics are stocks and bonds. And that's because when you look at a company, you have debt and you have equity. Either you are a financer of a company or you're an equity holder of a company. And I think that breaks it down in like its most, like breaks it down in its like real core essence. And essentially, make yourself like you would a bank. A bank either lends money or a bank takes a position in something. Mm-hmm. And personally, I try to replicate that.
But what about the people who say, well, that's great.
Let me ask you a question
that's safe, man. But I need to make money.
I mean, 78% stock isn't safe. I mean, it's, you know, the long-term returns are 7 to 10%, but it's not safe. Look at what the market has done from February to March. Look at what the market has done from March to now. I don't think that's safe. Look at what the market did in Q4 of 2018. So safe is like a relative word. If you're trying to, and I'm probably going to regret saying this, if you're trying to make trap-like returns, I mean, that's not what this is, right? This isn't quick flip. This isn't make 50 into 150 overnight. You know, I'm not going to get it. I can't get up here in good conscience and suggest that to anyone. If you want an increased amount of risk, you can still take that core portfolio and have that be your core. And then you slice off small pieces and take much higher risk, much higher beta, if you want to get into some of the technical terms, much higher R squared or volatility types of investments. But the key is having a core position, because if you don't have a base, you don't know where you're going. You don't know where you need to tweak, and you're just not involved in the market, generally speaking.
So, Bowen, real quick, you said that, you know, the basis would be stocks and bonds, right? So I'm thinking, and a lot of our audience is like, they're into options. I know Ian always suggests like, yo, take 500 jump shots when you're trading. When do you think it would be a good time, or is there a good time or a certain amount of trades that somebody should do or be involved in before they get into the options play?
Okay. No, that's a good question. Can I take just a quick step back before I move forward? If you all don't mind. So when I say 70-30, right, what I'm trying to do is give you something that's what we call an investable or replicable portfolio. Like clearly I'm a proponent of owning real estate. I'm a proponent of holding operating companies. I'm a proponent of all of that. But I want to make sure that I'm like giving you guys information that's actionable. For me to go say, hey, you should buy this type of company or a private company, I mean, you have to be an accredited investor to invest in privates. So yeah, I definitely think that should be part of your portfolio. But right now, I'm assuming that we're trying to make money and that you don't have $250,000 of disposable income that you can invest and not care. One, to be an accredited investor, I believe you have to have like $1 million of liquid assets or make $250,000 a year. And that's super high risk. I do think that there is room for that in a portfolio, but I'm purely talking about publicly traded securities. So I just wanted to clarify that. In terms of options trading, listen, I love options. Options have been good to me. That's my bread and butter. But man, like Ian, great question, man. Some of the stuff that I'm seeing is like literally having a portfolio of options. I mentioned this last episode, or the last episode I was on, right? Options give you leverage to and control of. That's very different than ownership, right? Options are all about timing, amongst other things. Volatility inputs, I'll dive into all that stuff. But you're betting that something is going to happen by a certain period of time. That is very dangerous to have all of your investable capital in a portfolio of options. Because I think of a portfolio as a going concern. If you listen to Bogle, Dalio, the Oracle of Omaha, Graham, all of the greats, right? All of them, mm-hmm. right? What they'll tell you is that time value of money is the thing that's working behind you. It's like the core tenet of finance. So you need compounding over time. And so what you need are securities that can be a linchpin of your investment portfolio out 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years, and then you tweak around that. So at what point should you have an options portfolio? Personally, never. I'm never going to have a portfolio of just options. At what point should you trade options? As soon as you're comfortable and understand the risks associated with those options. I don't want you to shy away from them. I wouldn't suggest, I would never suggest that anyone not use all the tools available to them in their toolkit. I just want to be very clear about investing, trading, core holdings versus trading positions. Options are trading positions. Investing is about holding for the long term or about holding for a certain target return on investment or IRR or whatever other way you want to judge your return. Does that answer your question? Thoroughly enough?
Is it if I can play devil's advocate,
let me ask you a question, Bonnie.
What would you recommend? Would you do 50%
being that, you know, 50, now 50%? It seems like...
Yes.
Now, yeah, would you recommend... Yeah. No, go ahead.
And this Zoom lag is serious. Okay, so... The question that I heard was
Shaggle.
I didn't hear Troy or I heard you say something about okay. So what? Playing devil's advocate, what percentage would you allocate to options versus stocks? Your options typically are probably break it down in terms of like return on investment or yes. percentage return, right? So. If you're going to own an option and you're going to pay, I don't know, $1 or $2 for it versus paying $50 or $100 for a stock, right? So your $2, you know, that's going to be about 5% of, you know, of that $50 that you would allocate. You can make a similar return on a much lower portion of capital expended, right? So I would say, okay, well, if you're expecting to make 5% would be 20x what you're making on your core portfolio, then you should only, I would allocate a fifth to that particular options trade, mm-hmm. right? It's all about like balancing the ratio in terms of expected returns. If I expect to make 10x on an option, then I'm only going to really probably do it, mm-hmm. right? If you are playing something that's like longer dated or you don't expect to make the same type of returns, I think you can invest a bit more, but options decay, right? Like stock isn't going to zero unless the thing goes bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Like you're gonna recoup something. And bankruptcies happen. Options, yes. if they don't finish in the money, quite literally decay to zero.
So I want to ask a question that everyone is going to ask later. And if I can get 10x in a year, why only put 1/5 in when I'm only going to get 10 to 20% long term? I'm playing devil's advocate because I'm going to get 1,000 people to ask me this question.
I'm saying if you can get 10x, invest a 10th, you have then. So, okay.
Because people want to do half and half. Yeah.
I can't tell people what to do, right? I want to be very cautious about saying, do this, don't do that.
Yeah.
We're all adults here, and ultimately your risk tolerance will determine how you're willing, how you're willing to kind of deploy capital. What I'm saying is looking at the returns is half, probably not even half of the equation, particularly when you're a professional investor. And a retail person can still be a professional investor. If this is what you say you do, if this is a hobby and you kind of want to just put a little money in the game, go for it, right? Because it's all about the learning experience and your enjoyment. If you're saying, this is what I do, you go to raise capital or you're talking to your clients and you talk about returns, any astute investor, the next question out of their mouth is going to say, what's your volatility of returns? How much risk do you take to get those returns? And so I really want to touch on, volatility in your portfolio, variance. You have things like standard deviation, R squared, Sharpe ratios. All of these things measure, and these are like, I would suggest you look these terms up. These are measures of return as they pertain to risk taken to achieve that return. So if you go back to like your most basic like capital asset pricing model, right? You move up risk, you should move up in return. But if I can take one unit of risk and get one unit of return, and you're taking two units of risk to get that same return, you're not doing something. I would sell whatever it is to you and buy whatever I'm getting all day. And so I think that the next part of that is, so for options, people talk about, okay, I can make 10X. You can make 10X for a certain factor of risk. What I would say is you can find something safer, deploy capital there, and just scale. Because you can grow the amount of capital that you're allocating there, or your notional exposure is what we call it. But if you keep your risk low, all you need to do is scale that same exposure. It's what banks do. It's what sovereign entities do. It's the basic of the banking system. It's like if you go to the bank, you put in deposits, they lend 9 times on that. That's super safe. A super safe business model. They just scale it. I'll be the bank. You show me a bank that doesn't print money, right? They don't exist, because if they don't make money, they go out of business. I wanted to dive in a bit deeper. I know that answer varied a bit, but it's not cut and dry. Like 50%, unless you're in options that are as safe as whatever else you're whatever other alternative asset you'd be investing in, I just don't think you can say this return versus this return, and therefore I should structure my portfolio this way. It's like, it's the whole reason you have stocks versus bonds. Like, why would I even bother suggesting that you allocate any money towards bonds, which is the largest market, right? Treasuries, like the largest asset. Why bother even investing in that stuff if it's all about return?
That's a great point. So what's a good safety range for volatility in your portfolio? So if you're looking at like your ultra index or anything similar, like what's a safe range that you want to be in?
Overall portfolio. I mean, a pullback or a correction in equities is considered 10%. I'm fine with that from an index standpoint.
Okay.
When it comes to trading single stocks, man, much more risk tolerance. In individual companies, 20-30% but again, this is me now. And then I want to take it a step further. If I'm looking at a growth company, 25-50% that's what you're signing up for. If I'm talking about like a more cyclical, a utility company, something that's like not going to grow, I'm going to probably cut that down by 2/3, right?
So our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
So, you know, my 30%, okay, I'll take about 10% there. My 60%, okay, I'm going to take about 20% there. You know, it's really about the ask us. And then when it comes to bonds, much lower volatility of returns. Really, typically what this stuff is measured on is like standard deviation. So you're going to go back and you're going to say, okay, how much has this moved from the life of this investment? And that's my average move. And then how many multiples of that average am I willing to take? So anything within a standard deviation, I'm fine with, right? That's your standard normal distribution. You should expect things to move there. When I start to see what we call 2, 3, 4 sigma moves or 4 standard deviations, you shouldn't be holding on to things that long. And then, you know, there's a term called 6 sigma event, which is like your black swan, things that really shouldn't happen. Things that are happening now, oddly
enough. Right now, yes.
So, you know, I'm really trying to give you kind of a all seasons type of investment strategy, but truthfully, really what I would do is I'd pick an index, because if you're looking at investing, right, you always have some type of benchmark. Mm-hmm. And that's why I went, go back to saying, listen, you got to have a core. You got to have something to compare to. You got to be tethered to something or you just float. So you look at your benchmark and you say, okay, that thing has a standard deviation of, I don't know, 5. All right. Now, how many more standard deviations am I willing to take if what I'm trying to replicate is tethered to that? And that would answer, I think that not only answers the question directly, that gives you the tool to determine what it is that you're benchmarking that particular investment to, and then determine how much risk you're willing to bear around that.
And how much should you be willing to draw down? Let's say if you do, okay, so you have long-term, you have bonds. What about options, futures, and any exotic derivatives if you're like structuring? Let's say you have 20% left for options, futures, and anything exotic.
Okay, so in terms of the exotic stuff, you know, that you'll need like an ISDA to trade, at least what we define as exotics, which are like bespoke option investments that are tailored to you.
Yeah.
Excuse me, you're going to have an ISDA with a bank to be able to do that. You don't have to be a high net worth individual, or as an institution, you're going to have what you call an ISDA. So I'm going to just like take that off the table because I just don't think it's like very relevant. I think that if you're young and risk loving, and you have like a stable source of income, I think you should go for it intelligently. That doesn't mean just go buying a strip of options, right? But the same portfolio that you have at 25 or 35 is not the same portfolio that you should have at 55 or 65. So I want to make sure I answer these questions in a way that apply to everyone, but that I don't give like a blanket statement that is damaging right? It's back to your first question. Like, these one size fits all answers are often given by people that don't have the information to give you a more specific answer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in terms of options and futures, right? It's about opportunity cost. So if you're saying, okay, right now what I own is I own SPY, I own the AGG, and then I've sprinkled in a little bit of Apple and Amazon and Zoom or whatever else, right? I would say, okay, so you have a core position. You clearly have a risk appetite because you're investing in growth companies that have revenues oftentimes that are like much farther in the future. And that's why these companies are sensitive to inflation, because you're discounting their cash flows over certain periods of time. I would say if you truly understand options and you're willing to trade them, then I would say, sure, take 5, 10, 15, maybe 20%. The thing, if you're trading options properly, you don't need that much. That's really the point I'm trying to make. Like, you don't need much. Like, you can literally make 20%. Like, the issue is that people aren't willing to take doubles and singles and triples, right? It's like all or nothing home runs. Like, so if you're investing a dollar in options and you make 30 cents, you're like, it's 30 cents, it's nothing. I'm like, you just made 30%. Mm-hmm. Show me a fund that returns 30% year on year. And I'm saying, if you can do that routinely, just scale your position. Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. Rashad wanted me to ask you, what are your thoughts on like IBB and the pharma sector going into the next 4 years, since Trump is seeming like he's going to concede here pretty soon?
I mean, I'm not going to speculate on what Trump's going to do, but yeah, it seems point. That way. That's a good question, timely question. As for IBB, so I've mentioned it a couple times. Really, I have been unwilling to take stock-specific risk on vaccine companies, right? You've seen Pfizer BioNTech came out with a vaccine, which, and this stuff is kind of funny to me, right? Came out, and I think the efficacy rate was like 90%. Then Moderna came out, mm-hmm. and they had 94.5%. Then 94, Pfizer was like, yes. Oh, we didn't finish our trial. It's actually 95%. Then AstraZeneca came out today and was like, okay, well, we have one. If we give the proper dosing, which is two doses, I think it was 65 or 70%, but we actually gave a half a dose and then followed up by another dose, and that one's 80 or close to 90%. So it's, you know, and what you've seen is on the news, those particular stocks run up, then the next entrant comes out, and that stock sells off, and the new stock pops, and it's kind of been somewhat of a domino effect. So that's why I suggested IBB, because it's like a biotech ETF that gives you the thematic exposure, right? Here, I don't have a strong view. So my view on COVID and a vaccine is not the same as me having a view on this particular company. This is an isolated event, an isolated pandemic. There's a solution here. There's going to be a truncated timeline in terms of when you're going to be able to derive revenue and profitability from this particular event. So I find it challenging for me to try to extrapolate like a whole business use case off of this one event. And that's why I liked IBB. I think there was actually on CNBC, shameless plug, there's a, I think it was a analyst from Jefferies who came out and made some really good points in terms of, okay, so it's one thing now to have the clinical trials and have this vaccine. It's a completely different, there's completely different structural and administrative logistical issues, challenges in terms of manufacturing and distributing the vaccine. And that's where the challenge really is going to be. IBB, if I remember correctly, has been trading in like this 130 to 145 type of range. I think that range kind of holds. Mm-hmm. I don't really see a ton of upside in that from here. So I think it'll be challenged, and those individual components.
Now, given you told us how to structure a portfolio, why do you think it's hard for people to stick to a plan, even though you're a professional and you do this for a living? Why do you think people still try and deviate? And can you explain that if you continue to tinker and try and accelerate your plan that you can end up breaking something that does work?
Yeah. It's human nature. It's FOMO, right? It's like there's always, and you know what? It's political in nature. It's media coverage. Like you always get bombarded and blitzed with like the new hot thing. No one talks about like the slow and steady race, slow and steady kind of grind to where you've gotten. And man, I think it's FOMO, really. I think people want instant gratification, and that's just not what this game really is about. I mean, you can make it, but for every winner, there's probably two or three losers. And the game, at least the way I've played it and the way it's worked for me, the game isn't about just celebrating winners. It's about cutting those losses before they become cancerous and ruin your portfolio. And so that's equally as important, if not more important, is being disciplined in a way that allows you to remove things from your life, generally speaking. You know what? You guys are always on here talking about, like, I love how you give like holistic advice, right? Removing things from your life before they grow and just fester and create irreparable damage, right? I'm speaking about investments here, but I think that like just generally applicable across the board. I really hope that kind of answers your question. I just think it's like, it's a lack of discipline. I think that what you're kind of bombarded by social media, especially now, and even traditional media that's always talking about the next hot thing. You gotta be in this, you gotta be in that, you gotta be in this. Things take time. Good things take a lot of time. Don't be afraid to kind of like slow cook your stew, keep it to yourself, and keep things kind of moving onward and upward. So, profitability is boring. Being wealthy is boring. Owning assets is boring. It's not flashy. It's the antithesis of that. Like not being a consumer is boring. Mm-hmm. Like, so, like for me, and I know for you guys, like, it's like you kind of nerd out on this stuff, right? Like I genuinely am like, I want to know about this company. Oh, someone's wearing that. Who makes that? And so when you kind of shift your mindset to that, like, fine, go buy some Nikes and then spend the $250 that you spent on some J's, go buy $250 worth of Nike stuff. If you're going to go buy the Louis bag, not my thing, but if you do, buy the same amount of LVMH. Hell, you're helping to drive their revenues. And so, you know, like, I think it's getting into that ownership mindset.
Troy wants to know, what are the catalysts that will make an ETF optionable? And then Rashad wants to know, what do you think the prospect of marijuana over the next 4 or 5 years? I know you've talked about MJ before, but do you think that it's going to be viable within the next 4 to 10 years? And kind of go on a cataclysmic run, maybe here in the next half decade or so.
So, MJ, I've mentioned, one of the guys on the show actually owns an ETF, CNBS. I just, because I'm going to mention it, so I want to make sure that it's full disclosure there, which is definitely more tailored. And I sat down and had a chance to talk with him. He's much more of a sitting expert on that topic than I am in terms of the actual nitty gritty financial details of each one of those companies, right? And his ETF, CNBS, which I'm also an owner of, I own MJ, is a bit more tailored to U.S. domestic growth, right? And so if you look at right now, it's really like a legal situation, right? Political situation. Do you believe over the long term that the state legislation will be robust and then lead to federal legislation? And I would liken it to prohibition, right? Like, fine, you've got Bud or Miller and all these other InBev and all these other companies. But like, I personally don't want to be on the front lines trying to pick individual companies, like in mass, right? Like thematically, I definitely believe. I do. I believe it. I think it's the next hot thing. Like, so, you know, what you have is medical use, you have recreational use, you have a government that needs an increased tax base. Kind of have all the makings for thematically why I think this has long-term staying power. The issue is that you can't really invest as an institution. You can't really bank as a marijuana company, right? So like the money has yet to really be injected into our financial system in a way that allows there to be institutional investment on a large scale. You're seeing it with Bitcoin now. Bitcoin's been here before. The difference is that institutions can allocate capital, right? So we're all talking about what should I buy, what should I sell, what should I trade. For the largest asset managers, a lot of them are like allocating towards something. It's not about buying it and then selling out of it. It's like, we're going to keep a portion of our holdings in this asset. And once the marijuana industry kind of is accepted and adopted in that type of way, I personally think you have massive upside. What I don't want is I don't want exposure to the individual fraud cases, which undoubtedly will come. I don't want the one-off exposure to poor management or robberies or raids or non-compliance or any of that. So that's why I like playing it through a thematic way. And that's why I suggest an ETF there. Or I have played an ETF there.
Okay. And from a strategy point, what do you wish that you knew from the very beginning that would have made your career and getting gains a lot easier?
Oh, man. That nobody knows. That you have as much information, ability and know-how at your own fingertips as anybody else that's going to get up and talk their head off about it. That's not to say that there's no experts, but like, don't victimize yourself in terms of your ability to do this, right? Don't sell yourself short. And like, for me, that was, and I'm not saying that's the most important lesson. That was the most important lesson for me because I'm the type of person that's kind of a perfectionist. And I'm like, I need to read this. I need to read that. I got to make sure I do this. I got to check this. I got to check that. Well, what happens if this happens? And if I had just gotten started earlier and been willing to take the risk earlier, understanding my temperament, right? Like, I'm not the type, I don't skydive, I don't bungee jump. I'm like too many life risks already as it is, right? So knowing my personality type, I'm gonna do the due diligence. And I think very early on in my career, I was so awestruck by the whole ethos of Wall Street, all these are the best and the brightest. And the truth of the matter is, and this is the reason why I'm here, because we belong here. We deserve to be here. That would have been super powerful for me early on to really recognize that.
So last time you were here, you gave us the calculation with the VIX of how to determine the true range and the internet went crazy. Do you have any other calculations or formulas like that that you can give us so you can break the internet again?
So I mean, I think Zoom's already broke the internet, but yeah, I think I have a couple for you. I want to make sure I go back over this, right? So this is like options 101, right? And what I was talking about was the VIX. And so the VIX is an implied volatility index. So anytime you have an implied volatility, it's normalized. So take that divided by roughly 16, really divided by the square root of 252. And that will give you the implied move on an annualized basis. The implied daily move on an annualized basis. Taking that a step further, I would say, and this is for all my options traders out there, look at the spread and the ratio of implied versus realized volatility.
Say that again.
Pardon?
Say that one more time.
So I would like, I think it would be very helpful, and something that I look at. Take a look at the implied volatility. And if all your trading, all the option trading montages will have, it'll be like IV. Mm-hmm. That just tells you what the implied. And I'm gonna spend some time here. That will tell you what the implied volatility is. The other half of that is what the realized volatility is. Implied is an assumption and an input into a model that kicks out what you take as your options price. The realized volatility is how much that stock actually realizes. And so if you continue to purchase implied volatility, but the stock doesn't realize that, you might think you're winning, but guys on the other side are also winning. It doesn't necessarily have to be a zero-sum game. So like I said, you can tell me to shut up, but I'm going to spend a little bit of time here because I think this is as powerful as that. Okay, so for most people, retail investors, when you're buying a call or a put, you're buying a call because you think a stock is going to go up. You're buying a put because you think a stock is going to go down, and vice versa by selling or writing those particular options. So what I'm saying is, for me, the way that I grew up trading, and this is on the institutional side, you will look at the dollar price, and I'm like, I don't care what that is. You need directional exposure for you to win. I don't care whether the stock goes up, down, left, right, or anything in between. I'm betting because what I'm doing is I'm stripping out all of that and I'm trading volatility. So when you look at your TD Ameritrade or E-Trade, or man, now I got to say them all, Scott Trade, Schwab, Interactive Broker, Robinhood, yeah. All of them. None of them are better than any of the other ones. Mm-hmm. When you see your implied volatility there, what that is telling you is you take your price, your forward stock price, dividend assumptions, interest rates, blah, 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 all of this stuff, right? And what you can do is you can strip out the implied volatility. And that's the most powerful piece. That's the most powerful input in terms of your option price. And so you may say, hey, Apple's a great stock. I'm going to buy calls. Whether it's at the money calls, in the money calls, upside calls, you're like, I want exposure to Apple stocks. The options only cost me $5. The stock trades at $400. This is a good trade. And I go, okay, that $5 that you just paid, that actually is a 160 ball. It's going to use a nice round number, implying that the stock is going to move 10% a day from now until that expiration. What I'm going to do is I'm going to sell you that call. I'm going to go buy the stock and I'm going to delta hedge. And I don't care if it goes up or down. As long as it doesn't go up or down, it's rate of change that I'm trading. As long as it doesn't go up or down by the 10% that you just paid for it, I win. Okay. And that's what you're trading. Pardon?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
And that's why like the volatility that you're paying for these options is so critical. And you asked about it earlier, but I'm getting into it now, and I knew I'd get a chance to kind of to get to this. This is the nitty gritty of options trading. So, and this is why I was hesitant to give you a cut and dry answer in terms of how much of my portfolio should be in stock and bonds or whatever, how much of my portfolio should be in options, because it depends on what implied volatility you're paying. If you're paying an implied volatility that's, go back and look historically. Let me add another thing. So look at the implied volatility of a stock and look at the historical implied volatility. The same way that you look at a stock chart and look at the range of the stock. And I would say stock price is one thing. What we should probably look at is like the price to earnings ratio or price to earnings to growth. But some ratio, right, that tethers you to something, that gives you a base. And I'm going to keep coming back to that word, base. So go back and see, okay, this has had this implied volatility over the life cycle of this company or over whatever time period you think is applicable, and then look and see what it is right now. If you're buying that stuff on the highs, then one, the amount that the stock has to move for you to finish in the money is much higher. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. you're probably better off just buying the stock if you're using options to take a directional view. That's the first part, right? So options, look at your implied volatility, look at the realized volatility, and then look at where, I mean, for me, like I'm looking at more statistics, look at what percentile those particular things are in. So if I'm seeing something that's in like the top, you know, decile, right? Like the top 10% of implied volatility, I probably don't want to buy that. The exact opposite in the bottom 10%. Most of the time it's going to be moving around like the median or the mean. But when you start to see, and then you can do this in an Excel spreadsheet, but average or mean, median, you can do standard deviation, STDEV, you can do variance. Excel will do all of this for you. And if I'm buying something in the top quartile or the top decile, no thank you. I'll just buy the stock. If I'm playing it for a directional point of view. And the exact opposite if things are in like very low quartiles or percentiles. The other thing is, so another thing for options is if you're long the stock and you notice that the implied volatility is super high, something that I like doing is selling calls. Even though you love the stock, it's not about the fact that, oh, I have to buy calls because I want the stock. The implied volatility is too high for that call, which is going to drive the higher the implied volatility. And you guys tell me if I'm getting too far in the weeds.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
You have your delta, right? Your delta is it's many things, hedge ratio for one, but it's your probability of finishing in the money. And that takes me to the next question. So how do I pick? Should it be in the money, at the money, out of the money? All right. Look at the delta of that thing. 50 delta means coin flip. 50% that it's going to be in the money, 50% that it's not going to be in the money. And the lower the delta, the lower the probability of those things finishing in the money. Now, I think this is the VIX moment. The higher the implied volatility drives your delta back towards 50. So the more expensive the option will drive your delta back towards 50. Those are the times where I'm not playing options that are close to the money because the implied volatility is so high. But the out of the money options, it means that that delta can change so much higher and get driven to 50. So a 20 delta, if I'm going to play options and it's going to be a lot of implied volatility, I'm probably going to play something out of the money because it will at least pull my delta closer to 50 as long as that implied volatility stays high. Excuse me.
Perfect.
Sorry, I kind of went off.
No. That's great. And everybody on YouTube is loving it too. I got a follow up from Troy. So obviously there's no way to time a trade. But would you give, after quadruple witching, would you give a time to settle or would you invest when the chain opens?
Sorry, I missed that last part.
Well, would you invest as soon as the chain is open or would you give a time to settle post quad witching?
Sorry, can you start the question from the beginning? I apologize.
No, so during quadruple witching, is it okay. best to trade when the chain is settled or should you invest as soon as it opens?
So your quadruple witching is going to be when you have like your futures and all your options, like index stocks and everything like expiring. So I'm a little confused by the question because like those things are gone. If you're talking about rolling them, mm-hmm. you're going to have to roll before that witching period or expiry or expiration is what I call it. So. And that's really the risk there with options. It's like, okay, it has a time period. The witching period that you're referring to is when all this stuff rolls off. For futures, you're going to need to roll out of whatever you're long into the next contract.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're taking like ESA or SPOOS, it's like HMUZ, right? You're March, June, Sep, December. The issue, though, is like a lot of that stuff is institutionally driven. So If you're waiting right to before that stuff expires,
you're in trouble.
You're like always going to pay some premium to roll up and out. Like you are, because these people need these futures positions to hedge. They have to put them on. And the amount of notional that's being traded is going to push it against you. And it's not going to be because, oh, this futures contract should be higher. It's purely supply and demand. For options, when I'm writing options, I'm cool to let them expire. When I'm buying options, I very rarely let them expire.
Okay. And from a hedging perspective, so let's say if VIX is at 24, we divide by 16, that puts us at 1.5. So if you were looking to place a stop, what percentage of that range would you place your stop if you know that you're going to have a range of maybe 1.5 or 2% for the day?
So that's like, okay, so that's going to be an implied range. Mm-hmm. Things can move less or more than that, just to be very clear. It's not a crystal ball. It's a, So if the VIX, just say the VIX is 24, for that particular day, one and a half to 2x that.
Okay. And of course, everyone traditionally says to invest in bonds and gold to hedge, but depending on what the timing of it, it may not have worked. What is the best way you think that people should be hedging their portfolio? Like, should you add certain commodities, a certain percentage of gold? Because everything is running high. The bond market was high in August. Gold is still running, almost feels like an index. What do you think is the best way to hedge truly in this market for like an all seasons type strategy for people that are looking
all seasons? Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. I'm going to answer your question with a question. What are you trying to hedge? Because I'm not trying to be like facetious or difficult. Like, I just want to make sure, like, I really want to take this time to make sure that like the audience is like understands, because you hear like these buzzwords thrown out. So gold is typically like a store of wealth. And so it's considered kind of an all scenario hedge, right? It's a commodity, so it's an inflation hedge. It is considered a store of wealth, so it's a hedge against people running for banks or sell-offs in other risk assets. But gold is still a commodity, which means that it's like bought and sold just as a store of wealth, meaning like it doesn't really have a use case. And so, and I think that's kind of getting exposed now and kind of why you're seeing Bitcoin and some of these all other alternative assets kind of come to play. One important thing to keep in mind is that like commodities, generally speaking, internationally are listed in dollars. And that's the real reason that these things, that it's considered a hedge in the way that it is, right? If you have like massive inflationary pressure, you typically want more exposure to commodities. But it's not because the commodities are, it's more like a technical situation, right? Mm-hmm. Crude is denominated in dollars, or oil, sorry. Nat gas denominated in dollars, gold, palladium, platinum, everything else denominated in dollars. So if it takes more of the dollars to buy whatever it is, it's like a tactical or technical type of, a mechanical type of hedge.
Okay. Yeah, I think people's biggest fear is, okay, well, what if I invest in tech, TAN indexes, and I don't have exposure to anything else, and it bottoms out, and let's say we have a 50% correction, I should have been hedged with gold, bonds, and of course, you know, the news cycle.
Okay, got it.
So maybe like 20 to 25% drawdown is what
people... Gotcha. Okay, thank you. Sorry, I didn't understand very well the first time. So, so the bonds typically, and I say typically only because we saw bonds get absolutely destroyed. Mm-hmm. That's a rare event, but bonds typically have like a much narrower... Now, when I'm talking about bonds, I'm talking about treasuries and I'm talking about high grade corporates. If you're playing in high yield, that's more like equity return. So like, I want to be very clear when I say bonds. excuse me, those are typically going to have much narrower bands of volatility. So even when the stock market crashes off, even in the same company, and I think this might answer your question. So when you look at the capital structure of a company or how a company funds itself, right? It has bonds or debt, loans, however you want to classify those. And then it has equity. And that's pretty much all of sources of cash for a company. Now, if a company crashes crazy, but still has enough money to service its debt, that debt can still continue to earn whatever interest rate that it was scheduled to earn, even though the equity is getting destroyed. In a bankruptcy situation, what's typically going to happen is that all of the equity holders are going to be wiped out. If it's a Chapter 11 or kind of a reorg, you're going to restructure the debt. You're going to allow yourself to pay back your bondholders over maybe different terms, different period of time, different interest rate, so forth and so on. And that's going to come at the expense of equity holders. So I think that's why bonds are thought of as a hedge to general markets. I think I've explained to you why gold is considered a hedge. Mm-hmm. But I also think volatility should be a hedge. If you're going to spend a ton of money buying calls, you should consider buying some puts as well. And do that when vol is at low ranges. Now, it's insurance, right? Like, but that's the ultimate hedge, is insurance. And you have insurance with anything. Typically, you don't need it. You pay this premium. It sucks, but like you go on about your day. But if you do that in ranges where you're paying small premiums, you have the ultimate hedge.
Mm-hmm.
So the best hedge would be if you're buying like an index, is a put on that index, but buy it out of the money. Like I don't think you should continue. Okay, so I bought this for 100. Now I'm gonna get the 100 strike put. Like no, yeah. Buy like the 90 strike put, or you're really worried about a 50% sell off. Buy the put that's down 30%. You'll pay close to nothing for it, and you don't have to worry about it. What we call correlation or proxy hedging, because there's times where stocks go down and bonds go down. And you're seeing it now. Stocks up, gold up, credit up. So, you know, these are proxy hedges, but it's never perfect. The best hedge would be insurance on what you own. And I just think, you know, if you're buying it for low volatility out of the money, you're typically going to pay a very small percentage for the event that you're really trying to protect against. And that event is something that cripples your capital base to a level where you can't really come back from. 10%, 15%, 20%, that's what you're signing up for. That's a standard issue in terms of equity performance. But, you know, you shouldn't allow your portfolio to get down 35, 40, 45%. No. Stops would be another form of insurance, which I would always suggest trading with a stop.
And what percentage do you think would be a safe allocation for those who are going to ask? Should it be 20%, 25%? What would be your cutoff point?
For options or for stocks?
For stocks.
Sorry. Stops. STOP.
Oh, stops. Okay. Got you.
The options, I would say, okay, if you have 100 units invested, how much does it cost you to protect 100 units? That's the amount.
Mm-hmm.
That you should put it. Or okay, if I have 100 units and I'm willing to lose 20 units, how much does it cost you to recoup 80 units? And again, I wish there was just like this uniform answer, but
an easy answer, yeah.
That's kind of what I'm talking. Like it doesn't work that way, right? Like you gotta put in either you put in the time. Or someone like Ian puts in the time and then kind of schools you to the game. But it's a zero-sum game. So, fine. You don't have 13 years, 15 years, 20 years to kind of replicate the amount of time that has been spent learning lessons in the game. Fine. But you've got to make that up with sweat equity and rigorous study and dedication. And, like, that's just kind of what it is. Generally speaking, I pick my stops based on previous technical levels. This is when I'm just trading. My portfolio, I have like my like core holdings. I've only like gone to cash in that situation on a bulk of that like once. And I don't want to misspeak, but I can think of like one time, and it's recent.
March.
I mean, I'm not going to get into that.
I got that. I understand.
But yes, but with that said, I always keep a certain amount of money in the market.
Okay.
Even in periods like March.
Okay.
Because my for that particular bucket is 40 years, 30 years.
And given where we are in a macro cycle, what do you think of SPACs and the current IPO market? People ask me. I'm just asking the questions that people want to know.
No. My response wasn't like, that's a dumb question. I was just like, it's just shocking the proliferation of these things. Listen, I think SPACs have some good aspects to them in terms of like, they allow you to kind of get like revenue projections, right? Which is like some type of visibility. I'm always hesitant to like be so old school and buck against like new innovation. Mm-hmm. So I think the market is ripe for it. What I think it is the market is telling you it wants growth. And the reason why it wants growth, because growth has outperformed for the last, I don't know, decade plus. Additionally, and I realize that there's been a rotation into value as of late. With interest rates so low, the rate at which you're discounting future revenues is extremely low, which makes those very attractive. Mm-hmm. As for the SPACs, I want to make sure I answer the question very, very directly. I think there's like a 20% rip in terms of like management fee, which is like kind of
that's crazy. High.
And I think you have like a 2-year period to identify like what your target is. So you're kind of essentially saying, okay, X, Y, and Z investor, here's money, go find something to deploy capital that is deserving of this investment. I mean, it's just, I think it's a bit frothy. I think the IPO market is a bit frothy. And I think the SPAC market is a bit frothy, but I think it's a function of where we are in terms of like our fiscal situation. Interest rates are so low. People want growth. The market has kind of continued to trend higher. Passive investments have done extremely well. And I mentioned this last time, if you're an asset manager or a money manager, you have to put money to work. Like you just have to. But it does feel a little topish. I'm a skeptic, but that's how I am by nature. So I think the SPAC market is either matched or overtaken the IPO market. I was reading something earlier today. The SPAC market this year has done more in terms of notional deployed than like the last 5 to 10 years of SPACs.
That's crazy. It definitely a sign of the times. On the institutional side, so what publications or sources are you using to gather some of your data to get an edge that us as retail investors don't have, and how can we maybe get our hands on some of that literature?
I read research reports. Some of that stuff is like our in-house stuff. Mm-hmm. So we have economists, we have strategists. You know, I read that. I mean, I don't know everything, and I like to hear smart people's opinions. I'm on Bloomberg all day, and so there's a lot of information there. In terms of basic stuff like daily reading, like the Journal, Barron's, Financial Times, I don't read all of those every day, but I read at least one or two of those every day. For me, Bloomberg kind of gives me access to a lot of WSJ articles. Barron's, I absolutely love. Harvard Business Review, The Economist, and research reports and strategy reports.
In your experience, how does partisanship affect the market? And then, or do you think it'll have a big effect on how things are going to play out the next 4 or 5 years?
Great question. Super timely as well. Same with Rashad's question about IBB. So there's like this misnomer that Republicans are better for the market. And if you go back, there's been many studies done. Like, there is no definitive statistical correlation between any party and the market. Mm-hmm. There is higher convicted or higher statistically significant data correlated to economic performance as defined by rate of employment, GDP output, things of that nature. But I want to be very clear, like, the market and the economy are not the same thing.
Yeah.
They are not. And if this year didn't teach you anything else, that is abundantly clear. There is a bit more around that, but what there is, again, great question, and I'm hammering this point home, and I'm sorry to like say this ad nauseum, but like it's super critical. Where there is a correlation between returns is long-term investing. Those are just the facts. There isn't.
Okay, to follow up, what are maybe like...
I'm like George. Republicans buy sneakers, Democrats buy sneakers. It's cool. I don't care.
But are there any like 4 or 5 economic KPIs that you're looking at that would be a catalyst?
Oh, surely.
You can push the market up?
Employment rate, defaults, GDP output, and forward-looking price to earnings.
Okay, can you say those one more time? Because I'm sure some people missed them.
Sorry.
GDP.
So GDP, employment rate or unemployment rate, however you want to look at that. Defaults, so that's on the credit side.
That's huge.
And forward-looking price to earnings.
Okay. And my final question for you, what is one final piece of advice that you want to give everyone here to make them a better investor so we can have returns like you?
One piece of advice. Don't listen to advice.
Stop taking more.
Sorry?
Go into more detail on that.
So there's a book I'll probably post at some point, Reminiscences of a Stock Operator.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shiesty game. It's a cold game, right? And this dude had made and lost a ton of money many times over. And he got trapped into a situation where someone suggested that he buy a product first to his wife and then to him while they were shorting. And I say that now, particularly because this brings you back to the first question you asked, right? The information age, and oh, sorry, the last two questions, actually. The first question and the question you just asked me. The information is no longer at a premium. Like, yes, I'm going to have analysts that are producing information that you don't have packaged well for you. But information is not at a premium anymore, right? Before, it's like, okay, actually have information that other people don't have. What's at a premium is filtration of that information, because you're on social media or whatever, and people are like, oh, you should buy this, or you should sell this, or my auntie sister's cousin did this, or I turned this into this, or no, you shouldn't flip, you should be you should be a middleman, or I forget what the term is. No, you shouldn't take traditional lending, you should take hard money lending. No, you shouldn't buy traditional assets. You should only buy growth companies. Or I happen to buy Apple, and you know, they said I should diversify. It's the only stock that I had. And I'll ask questions like, "Oh, okay, but like, what other decisions have you made? So you, what have you done with the Apple money? Right? Like, Do you own your home? We can go.
Ernest, let me let you in on a little secret. If you're looking to get meals that you'll enjoy and your bank account will love delivered straight to your doorstep, I want you to check out our people over at Every Plate. Every Plate dinners are the cheaper alternative to takeout or delivery. Their recipes come together in about 30 minutes, definitely faster than a trip to the grocery store or starting a meal from scratch. Every Plate does the meal planning, shopping, and prepping for you, taking the time-consuming guesswork out of cooking. Trust me, this helped me tremendously in the kitchen. All I had to do was follow the directions, use my ingredients, and put together some of the best chicken stir-fry I've ever had. I'm gonna be honest, at first I was skeptical, thinking that the meal kit thing might be a little bit too expensive. But now I know you can get the same deliciousness at a much lower price. And if you act now, you can get 3 weeks of Every Plate meals for only $2.99 per meal by going to everyplate.com and entering the code MarketMondays3. That's right, 3 weeks of free Every Plate meals for $2.99 per meal. All you have to do is head over to everyplate.com and use the code MarketMondays3. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over there.
To other tangents, because, like, as I said, you know, I'm an investor across asset classes. But my to answer your question again succinctly, stop taking advice, or at the very least, be super critical in your thinking about who you're taking advice from. And if the person who's giving you advice hasn't done it, and doesn't, not just hasn't done it, because you hear people, I've been doing this for 20 years. Yeah, man, things change.
Yeah.
So don't take advice from people that don't do it or haven't done it. And temper the advice that you take from people that used to do it, but no longer do it, because the game has changed.
Yeah. Yeah. My last final question for sure. Are there any, when you're trading, are there any technical indicators that you're looking at, or are you going from more of a fundamental standpoint to make your decision if you're going to buy or sell a particular asset?
Trading, you got to look at technicals. I definitely think so. I mean, fundamental analysis will give you like an understanding of the company and will make it so that when maybe something breaks down with the technicals, you're not like, you don't have that oh snap moment. You know what I mean? Yeah. But trading is about like momentum and where things have been and volumes. But generally, if I'm looking at like some fundamental stuff, because what you have now is like a cross pollination between, so people talk about quantitative research, quantitative analysis. Mm-hmm. Like it's like a cross pollination between like very technical analysis and then the statistical analysis of the actual balance sheet or fundamental. So, for example, people were asking me about the cruise lines earlier or the airline, and I see these stocks have popped back. I'll tell you, I don't understand why. Those companies have so much debt on their balance sheet now. Like, if you were saying, okay, these were operating at 100% capacity, or no, probably not 100% capacity, but like 90% capacity, it's down to 50. Now these companies have like another, I don't know, I think American has like $50 billion of debt or something like that.
Yeah.
It's got to pay that debt before the equity holders see a penny. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to happen at 50% capacity or 30% capacity or wherever we are right now. Moreover, companies are in the business of making money. And like, I'm going to cut myself short. I don't want to get super long-winded, but I think that part of the work from home situation is here to stay. If I can, and you hear this term called operational leverage, essentially expanding margins by cutting costs. I'm like dumbing it down, but like, I don't want to use the word dumbing it down. Sorry. I'm
simplifying it.
Complicating it and simplifying it.
Yeah.
In a way. And I just don't want to like, I don't want to know. I come here and I really try to give you guys like detailed information. So, I think that part of the work from home is here to stay, right? Because, you know, for a lot of people, the revenue producing units of a company may need to be in-house. But the support roles, like the processing, the back office, the middle office, logistics, the administration, you don't need to rent, I mean, office space in San Francisco or New York on Park Avenue if those things can be done from the comfort of someone's home. So I think part of that is kind of here to stay. And I think that is going to kind of change the way everything is done. The technicals, and I'll bring this full circle. The technicals keep me from getting so out of whack one way or another, that I kind of miss a trend. And that's why I think the technicals are important. Even if I'm looking at the fundamentals of a company, it's really hard, particularly for like new companies or growth companies. The previous performance doesn't tell me anything. So it doesn't reconcile with why I'm buying into it, because, you know, I'm looking at a company that I think has a thematic reason. Let's take Zoom, for example. Like, when has Zoom made money? But what you've seen is like a pull forward, and what you can say is, okay, I have all this user engagement, and so I'll be able to offer this service or that service, and you can extrapolate that forward. And that's why I need the technicals, even though I can say, all right, well, the company only did $500 million in revenue 2 years ago. I need to see a growth rate so that I think it can get to X by the next 5 years or so. So technical indicators, I would say 150-day moving average, 200-day, 50-day. Price to earnings, it's not really a technical thing, but I'm definitely looking at price to earnings. I'm looking at implied volatility. I'm looking at realized volatility.
And what PE ratio do you like?
For what type of company? I mean, if you're looking at like the FANGs, I mean, these things are like 60 or something like that, right? So for a growth stock, you're going to pay a much higher PE. For like a value company, some of these, you know, like 16, but it's like what I do is I look at what historical price to earnings has been and try to buy things that aren't necessarily on their highs. That's part of it. The issue right now is that everything is trading close to their statistical highs from price to earnings. And that's where the technicals come in.
All right, my last question, because I don't want to get beat up by Rashad and Troy. What's your favorite technical indicator that most retail traders do not know about? I have to ask, because I'm going to die if I don't know.
Favorite technical indicator that most...
Because my friends are working funds, they're like, okay, great. Go ahead.
I think I gave it to you in terms of the VIX, man. Like, that will tell you what one should expect in terms of price movement.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not going to just sit here and make stuff up, man.
I appreciate that.
I mean, yeah. Do I have things in my models that... I'm like, okay, well, okay, so, oh, fine. I'll try to drop something different.
Thank you.
I will take a basket of ETF. Let's take like XLE, XLK, XLI, sorry. XLK is tech, XLI is industrials, XLU is utilities, XLS financials, XLK is tech, XLV is healthcare. What else do we have? XLE, XLP, that'll be your staples. XLY will be your discretionary. So fine. So I'll take a basket, right? And I'll look at maybe the S&P as well. And I'll say, all right. So for any index or ETF, what you're going to have is a rebalancing. So bad companies or companies that don't meet a certain threshold get taken out. So like you naturally get rid of like idiosyncratic risk, right? So a bankruptcy, for example, isn't going to shock that portfolio the same way. Oh, and I'll use market cap. I don't like price weighted. So the Dow, I don't do it. I don't like it as much. And honestly, that's a big reason why institutional investors look at the S&P versus Dow. And I don't like volume weighted indexes either, because what happens is an event happens and a particular stock trades a ton, and then it becomes a disproportionate weighting for that index. So I'll take like a basket. Let's just take those ETFs, for example. I'll compare them to SPY, and I'll say, okay, what's the average move? What's the average implied volatility? Okay, what's the average realized volatility? And then I'll take that over that basket. And then I'll say, okay, what is moving much more than that, to the right or to the left? And then I'll get like an indicator that something looks too high or something looks too cheap. That gives me an indicator to go do some digging into something. But that's like a quick quantitative screen, or one that I built, right? So, and it's like something that's like that you can replicate. Take a basket of indexes. So, stock, it doesn't work for stocks because you have idiosyncratic risk. Take something that is routinely rebalanced so that you remove tail risk, idiosyncratic risk. All right, take that, compare that versus a benchmark. You can use S&P, you can use a Dow Jones. I gave you why I don't particularly like the Dow Jones.
Yeah.
You can use Qs, you can use whatever. And then what you do is take the mean and median, and the, and then you're also going to need your standard deviation mm-hmm. of those things. I look at the implied volatilities there because, again, this is options trading. And I'll say, okay, the implied versus realized ratio typically is here for these names. When I see something that's like, and you have your standard deviation. So you know things typically are 67% between a standard deviation higher or lower mm-hmm. than your mean. So if I see something that's like 2 standard deviations or 2.5 standard deviations high, it screens it for me. 2.5 standard deviations low, screens it for me. And then that lets me go, okay, this is something that I should actually take a look at. What's going on here and why? I think that's a technical indicator that probably most retail investors don't have.
So
you can build yourself in an Excel spreadsheet, and it will at least give you a shovel to start like doing some digging.
So you're using a screener to tell you when it's outside of the deviation? Oh, my God. Okay, thank you.
That will work for any mean reverting asset, because stock price is not mean reverting. Oh, maybe, sorry, I should have mentioned your fixed moment. Volatility is mean reverting.
Okay. Tell everyone what that means.
It means that when you can expect things to snap back to the averages. Because, I mean, in terms of like the long-winded explanation, like a stock price can continue to go up, right? It's not like you can say stock over the last 100 years was $50. If it gets to 100, it's going back to 50. No. But volatility, assuming a company doesn't get like bought out or go bankrupt, volatility being that it is statistically derived formulaic tool, it is mean reverting, like by mathematical definition. So when you see things gap high or gap low, and let me take a step back and like do and put it in like kind of like lay terms. So a company comes out, revenues just first start, and it's probably more volatile. And then a company becomes more mature. You understand the revenues a bit more. You understand the cost structure a bit more. People understand what it is. And you'll see, like, the stock trades in a range or it moves up kind of lockstep. Now, again, it's the rate of change, of volatility, how fast something is changing is mean reverting, not where it's going. That's mean reverting. I want to be very, 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 okay. very clear. But I think that's powerful information for all the option traders out there, right? Like you, when you see things move away from the mean or the median, they should be similar unless you have some tail risk, but a standard normal distribution, your mean equals your median. And I think it's 66.7% of observations fall within a standard deviation below or above that mean, which equals median. When you see moves that are multiples of that standard deviation, I tend to fade those. And you can express those views directionally if you so choose. So when I see a stock, when I see an index, and I see the implied volatility at, let's call it 32, right? So 2%, roughly. And I see a move of 4%.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably not going to just go buy that stock, but I'm probably going to go sell some puts there because it's now gapped. The implied volatility has jumped. I know over longer periods of time that the stock doesn't do that. And I'm going to say, okay, that's fine. I'm going to look at a technical level. I'm going to say, here's support. I'm willing to sell a put here. And in addition to that, I'm going to use this put strike with this implied volatility, because I know over longer periods of time that it does not continue to move at this rate continuously.
I appreciate that. I hope everyone.
Sorry, I felt like you're a little disappointed. You're like, come on, man.
But even on the equity side, I want people to catch. You're essentially saying that since it doesn't revert, it's going to tend to the upside. And then, of course, volatility is going to mean revert and slide back in. That's very insightful and helpful on its own for people to stop trying to short quality companies. Because look at all the people that have been shorting Tesla since 310 or 250. And they've been getting torn apart. So, but I can keep you here all night. I want to be respectful of your time and also my brothers at EYL. And we can start to, because we had some technical difficulties. The devil was trying to play some tricks on us. But you know, man, I love chatting with you. We can be on here to midnight, but I don't want to ruin our friendship and my friendship with Sean and Troy either. So we'll table it for another day. Man, I greatly appreciate you. And you've helped me a lot. Even tonight. So I want to thank you again for being amazing, always being a gracious guest, and you know, you family. So whenever you come on, I want you to just have the floor. And just
I appreciate it, man. It's a pleasure, guys. Thanks for letting me come back. And to the viewer and the audience, man, thank you guys for like sticking with me and showing me love. It's important that we get this information. I'm not right about everything, but I'm not selling anything. Like, we deserve to have this information. It shouldn't be locked up in the safe. A lot of other people have this passed down by their fathers or uncles or grandfathers or mentors. And it's just important that, like, we get it. And I hope that, my hope is that there's another young up and coming sister or brother that I can sit down and go, so yo, young buck, tell me how it's moving now. But it's important that this information, that people aren't intimidated by the market, aren't intimidated by investments. It's investing is timeless, man. It's been around since forever.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate you taking it. For everyone also listening, it's not often that you're going to get a chance to sit down and listen to a brother who is on this side of the investment table. So everyone say thank you in the comments to him, because if you try to get someone like him to give you a consult and break that down, it's going to cost you a pretty penny. So, and thank you for being on the institutional side to actually share some information that will give us on the retail side an edge as well. So thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
For Rashad, I'm sorry. I promise you I didn't plan this for Zoom. So we're going to have to do it like a part three.
You can hear us? We good?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, man. Ian said he wanted his Oprah moment.
Yeah, man.
And look at
I said, man. Took the show.
They made sure it happened. That was super impressive. We appreciate you for that, bro. That was good. We're going to call him King Bo from that one. Bottle in, the king. Shout out to you. EYL University Market Mondays contributor, man. Another amazing performance. You. Fire emojis, please. Fire emojis.
Yeah, fire emojis. Because for those of you who trade options too, I know he blessed you with something, but equities traders and futures traders, even on the futures side, it helped me. I'm like, okay, great. If I know we're going to move up 2%, like having a 1.5% target, a 1.2% target, that helped a hell of a lot from when you shared that. So thank you. Ooh, like, you guys,
I got some notes, man. I got notes.
Yep.
For real.
Me too. Yeah. Tons of them.
Appreciate that, man. Thank you. Thank you both of you guys for holding down the show. We were spectators today, but it was good to watch, so I appreciate it.
Just like the one game when the bench player like get 20. You're going to put up 80 next week, man. You still Kobe? Come on, let me get my little booty chitch off. No, I appreciate you, for real.
Nah, it's all good. So, all right. Any last words?
Yeah, man, it is Thanksgiving week, so we want to make sure that everybody stays safe, but also people get to reach out and help people if they can, and spend time with your family, your loved ones. That is super important. And we want to thank every one of you, everybody that's watching right now. Thank you. You have made this year a spectacular one for us here at EYL. So we want to give thanks to you, because without you, you know, believing in us and spreading the word and telling a friend to tell a friend, it wouldn't be possible. So we are indebted to you. So thank you for that.
Yeah, for sure. And don't forget, tomorrow we got a Wall Street Trap.
The big trap.
EYO 110, crazy 110 episodes that quickly. Wow. And we're going to be on Trapping Tuesdays as well. And then he's coming back on Wednesday. So it's a full week of, it's all investing this whole week. Hopefully you could just learn something and apply it. And then, yes, we are running that 50% off EYO University 24-hour flash sale. I'll put it in here. If you guys are interested, the code is EYO50. And once again, thank both of you guys for holding it down. Yeah. Zoom, no, Zoom definitely hated on us. That's part of business. There's always problems in any type of business that you run. It's always a problem. So it's about just, you know, managing the problems. And like they say on Broadway, the show must go on.
It's got to go, man. Shout out to Big. We got Big Snow in the back. Shout out to Jeezy and Gucci for that epic battle. And I put, we got trap music up there. That's his favorite album. So I put it up there for him.
This has to be like what Steve Kerr felt like when he hit that shot with MJ throwing the ball. Yes. I love y'all, man. I appreciate y'all so much.
Hey, yo, real quick. Shout out to EYL legend. It was his birthday today, man. Shout out to none other. Then my God, Disney Killer. Nacho Benga. Today's his birthday, man. Shout out to him,
happy
man.
Birthday.
Happy birthday.
He's a legend.
Happy birthday, Nacho. Yeah. All right, guys.
All right, y'all. Be good. Have a good turkey day and enjoy yourselves. Thank your family, but be safe, most importantly.
Peace.
Holidays. Peace. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you, brother.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.